typical immigrant story. Grandfather came over, was here for 6 years. My grandmother was back in Poland with three little boys. You know, he was working a less than minimum wage job, just putting every penny away until he could send for my grandmother to come on a ship. 6 years later, I mean, we all have stories like that, but I think to take a minute to reflect on we are here today because of what other people did before us is something that I really appreciate.
Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning with me, your host, Oz Rashid. This is the show where we learn from executives and founders who are disrupting and changing their companies and industries and find out what they uniquely see, what others don't, when it comes to identifying top talent. If this is your first episode, welcome. We are so glad to have you. If to our longtime listeners, we appreciate your support. Everybody listening, please subscribe on Apple or Spotify or wherever you find your podcasts. Today, we are joined by a very special guest. We are joined by Lori Marcus. Lori is the founding member of the Band of Sisters. We're going to get to that in a minute, but how you doing, Lori?
I'm good. It's nice to be with you today.
I'm so excited to have you here. Author, marketer, executive, philanthropy, you do it all, and we're going to dive into it. I want to start here, though, because this is a show about talent. It's about careers. It's about professional world. So let's start here. You are an accomplished marketing executive, and you work for some of the biggest brands in the space, PepsiCo, Keurig, Peloton. I might have used all of those products at some point this morning already. How did you first get into marketing?
I studied marketing in college. And what happened was I went to college. I had no idea what I was going to do. I knew a lot of things that I wasn't good at. My mother wanted me to be a lawyer, but I am a slow and deliberate reader and a slow and deliberate writer. And if you know anything about being pre-law, being a history major, that's just not going to fly. And so I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I was very good at French. Not sure what I would do with that. And then I went to University of Pennsylvania. I transferred into the Wharton School my sophomore year. I took a marketing class, and without sounding dramatic, I feel like it changed my life. I found something that I just immediately, it resonated with me. And I really like, even though I would consider myself someone who's strategic and conceptual, I also like things that you can see, feel, taste, touch. And if you think about consumer goods and consumer goods marketing, right? You think about product and product on a shelf and what the packaging looks like and how you're going to price it, why people buy it, what could you do to get them to buy more of it. I just thought it was all kind of this unique combination of intellectually stimulating and interesting and something that I could wrap my mind around versus chemical reactions in chemistry or even macroeconomics, where I just struggled a little bit more with those subjects. So I feel very fortunate that at 18 or 19 years old, I found something that I liked. I was lucky enough to be at a large university where I could avail myself of that coursework. And so that was that. I majored in marketing, and, you know, right from the day I graduated from college, I feel like I've been lucky enough to do things in the consumer space, largely around marketing and general management.
I'm going to come back to that in a minute. A couple sure. commonalities. My dad always wanted me to be a lawyer growing up, so much so that he used to give me these like big, thick business law books and have me read a chapter. And then he'd give me questions, and I would get $5 if I could answer all the questions correctly. So I was one of the few like 8 or 9 year olds who knew what tort law was and different things like that. And then ultimately, I actually was planning on going to law school up until I graduated from college, and then got pulled into the kind of the corporate world because I thought it was going to pay for my law school, and then never ended up going to law school. So I think it's probably the right decision for both of us.
I think we both probably
found our callings.
But I
absolutely love that. Also, Penn, Wharton, incredible school. So you're getting like one of the top marketing educations you can get. I'm interested in the consumer packaged goods because, you know, this is something I learned pretty early on in my career, especially when I started recruiting executives in the marketing space. CPG is the be all end all when it comes to great marketers. Yeah. I would be working with people in financial services and retail and automotive, and they would say, get me CPG, get me CPG, yeah. get me CPG.
Yeah.
So did you fall into the first CPG role, or you like intentionally went and pursued it, and where was it?
Okay. So first of all, I'm going to share one other story with you. I don't always think like things are meant to be, but I'm going to share one story and you can cut it out if you don't want to use it.
I'm not cutting anything out. Share it.
So later in my career, maybe, I don't know, 5 or 10 years after I was at Pepsi, and I'm going to answer your question. I was in a, I was working in new products and we were doing a home use test, which is, you know, that's when you're doing product development. And you need to actually get it into consumers' hands for more than just a sip test at a mall or at a central location. And so you actually send people home with a, in our case, it was Pepsi. So a, you know, a 6-pack or a 12-pack of, I was working on a coffee cola flavored product, doesn't matter what it was, but it's a very standard thing in consumer goods. And all of a sudden I have this out of body experience, a little bit of deja vu, like, I think I've been here before. And I remembered when I was a kid, like probably 4 or 5 years old, my mother used to participate in consumer research. So we would have, I can remember in my parents' little bathroom, there'd be like 2 different mouthwashes, one that said like 5014 and one that said 5015. And we'd have, you know, I don't know if it was Unilever or who was doing the studies, but we had, you know, mouthwashes, deodorants, probably cosmetics, things like that. And my mom used to do the home use test of it. And then we would go to some place where they would sit in a focus group. And my mother would be one of the people. I was sitting in the corner with a coloring book, but my mother would be one of the quote unquote housewives who was interviewed about her experience with the product. I had completely put it aside, didn't have any memories of it. We never talked about it. I didn't know what it was called. And it wasn't literally until like 30 years later that I'm organizing a home use test. And I'm like, oh my God, I am a child of consumer goods market research. I was meant to be here. Anyway.
Can I throw something at you real quick? Because that makes me think of something. And I'm, listen, here we go. I'm about to be super vulnerable right now.
Go.
I had a similar awakening. So obviously my career is in helping people find their dream job, career fulfillment, connecting people and opportunities. Like that's what our company does. That's what our software does. And so I had a similar unlock about 10 years ago. It was about 5 years after I started the company. And I'd been kind of evangelizing this message and it mattered deeply to me. And I was super passionate about it. And I realized that if I look back at my father's career, right? My father would be what you would call a jumper, right? You would look at his resume and he would have great brands and great companies he'd work for, but he went job to job. And there was always a bunch of different reasons, most of the time looking for, you know, a slight raise or whatever it may be. But I also remember like listening in the car to him and him talking and he just lacked fulfillment and he saw it as, you know, a transaction almost. And I go in, I put the work and I get paid. And that's a fine thing, but like, I could tell he was very unfulfilled with that. And I had a similar moment where I was thinking about, why do I care about this? Why does it resonate so much with me? And subconsciously, I realized that a lot of those conversations with my father put that drive me. So it's just so funny how, you know, carp before the horse or chicken before the egg or whatever it may be. You can look back at your career experiences and tie it back a lot of times to things that you experienced in your youth, which is exactly the case with you and those youth studies and listening to your mom talk about it. That's amazing.
Yeah, so funny. So back to the question that you actually asked, not the one that I chose to answer. So back, this is going to sound very funny to all the young digitally native people that are listening to your podcast right now. So back in the day, back in the early 80s, the way that it worked when you were looking for a job is I was fortunate enough to be a university that had great career planning and placement, but companies would come to Penn and you would literally slot your resume. In other words, take a paper resume and like put it in like a box and it would be for like the Bloomingdale's training program or for IBM, whatever. And you kind of chose where you wanted to asked to be interviewed, and then you would find out if you were interviewed or not. So I was going on lots of interviews that way. Companies would actually come to campus and do in-person interviews. And I was doing all the standard ones. I was looking at retail. I was looking at places that had training programs. And this was early 80s. You really just needed to get a job. It was not a great job market for young people coming right off the college campus. And a friend of mine had found a job at a company called Majors, M-A-J-E-R-S. It later became part of Nielsen Marketing Research when it was bought by Dun & Bradstreet. But he said he had found the company on his own. He had an offer there. And he just mentioned to me in passing, he's like, you should put your resume in for that. It's a company, it's in the syndicated data business, and they work with consumer goods companies, and they help them analyze all the causal data that impacts companies' performances in grocery stores. I had no idea what he was talking about, but it sounded good. It sounded kind of consumer products adjacent. And at that point, you really couldn't get a job in consumer products marketing other than maybe Procter & Gamble. Most of them only hired MBAs for the most part. And so there I was as an undergrad. Anyway, long story short, I applied for the job. I ended up getting, recruited right off the Penn campus. One of my, favorite bosses of all time, a guy by the name of Dave House, recruited me right off the Penn campus. I went to Atlanta. And what was great about it was here I was 21 or 22 years old. Our clients were major consumer goods companies. So I was sitting there in Atlanta. My clients were Coca-Cola Company, Maybelline, Tropicana, Florida Department of Citrus, and there I was at 21 years old presenting to VPs and SVPs at these major consumer products companies. And so that was just very fortunate. I don't think I ever would have put my resume inside the little mail slot that said majors, M-A-J-E-R-S, were it not for Phil Cohen suggesting that I did that. And I feel like that was really what launched me into consumer products very early on in my career without an MBA. And like I said, working with kind of the heavyweights in the CPG industry.
Yeah, well, I find fascinating about it. My big takeaway there, besides the serendipity,
yes,
is giving young, talented people opportunities beyond the scope and pale of what you would expect to be
yes.
at 21 years old.
Yes. Yes.
Usually translates to a very successful career. And that is something that I don't know that every person prioritizes when they walk into a new role, when they walk into a new company. Am I going to be given that opportunity? Like, we love to stretch people here at our company. Mm-hmm. And it's for that very reason, because the faster you get the reps, the faster that you learn
yes.
and even fall on your face, the more likely you are to ascend and really achieve great things in your career. Would you agree with that?
I couldn't possibly agree with that more. And the other thing, I've told this story a couple of times over the past few years that I didn't appreciate at the time, but talking about stretching people. So what I was responsible for as a young, promotion analyst or whatever we were called, I was responsible for analytics. And keep in mind, we didn't have big databases and computers. I mean, believe it or not, I'm going to say a word you haven't heard in 30 years, which is microfiche. So
no
the
way.
Data that we had was on microfiche machines. And
I had to go to a library to see microfiche. So, wow.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. We pulled it manually. And then it was very manual, but eventually you got the data and then you got to the insight. So it was kind of what you would now call kind of data and analytics, but I would say early days of data and analytics. It was also presentation, right? So you would go to Maybelline or Coca-Cola or Tropicana, or later I was calling on Nabisco. And here you were, this very young, inexperienced person presenting to very senior people, not once, but pretty, we'd go in every other month. I mean, on a pretty routine basis. And my boss always let me present. So analytics, presentation skills, and then the other thing, maybe not day one, but definitely year one, we each had a new business target. So it wasn't just that I was responsible for, with my boss, renewing the Tropicana contract and selling them incremental services, but we each had to do cold call new business. And so what's incredible about that is those three things that I just described, I think in today's world would be in three different departments. You'd either be doing data and analytics, or maybe you'd be somebody like in an ad agency who is pitching new business, or you would be, sort of doing new business. And the fact that I got to do all of that at 21, 22, 23 years old, some of it I was better at than other, certain things you're better at than you are at other things. But you got to really learn kind of the full ecosystem of how business works. And you also learn at, that grid of like what you're good at, what you're not good at, what you like, what you don't like. You can sort of put those things where they go on the grid, but it doesn't mean you only do the things that you're good at. So I agree with you in such a fulsome way that you want to give people a chance. I worked my heart out there, And I loved it. And it gave me great experience. And people took a chance on me. After 2 years of being in Atlanta, I was a little bit itchy to get back to the Northeast. I made my intentions known. And I was also ready to get promoted. And I worked really hard. But I ended up getting a promotion to come back to their Stamford, Connecticut office. And there I was at, 24 years old. And I was calling on Nabisco, the largest client in the whole corporation, wow, not just for the Stamford office, but the whole corporation. And so there's so much in there, Oz, not just about giving people like big and meaty jobs and taking a chance on them, but also sponsoring them. And, you know, like I said, the person who hired me off the college campus was also the person who pushed and pulled and sponsored me to get that job back in the Northeast. And I think I've lived in Connecticut ever since.
What a great story. Yeah. So the managers and employers listening, please empower your early in career talent, particularly if they're young women. So now let's talk dismantling gender bias. Oh, that's what we call a segue in the
nice,
professional community here.
Really nice.
Wow, hit that, nailed that. So dismantling gender bias in the workplace is something you are super passionate about.
I am.
I'm just interested. You've had, as we already heard, the beginnings of a very illustrious career. What were some of the experiences you encountered, right, positive or negative, that helped kind of like shape this belief that you have on the importance of this?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, I would say it started, I was very fortunate in my career, I should say that. I mean, I worked in consumer products. I worked mostly in marketing and general management. So I didn't work in what you would call like a male dominated, super, you know, aggressive field, which we talk to a lot of people today who say, you know, how does your experience translate? But that's a different story. But I should say I was very fortunate in terms of where I chose to work, who I was fortunate enough to work for, all of that. And I think it started with, you know, I'm one of, there's, you know, two daughters in my family. I didn't realize it at the time, but my dad was a super feminist. He didn't call it a feminist, but he was just very practical. He had two daughters, and he always said to us, you need to go to college and get a degree in something where you can get hired to do that thing. And you need to be able to support yourself for your whole life. He was a little ahead of his time. I think some people back in the day were still saying, like, you'll get married, you'll marry wealthy, someone will take care of you. My dad was not like that. He really wanted us to be independent minded. And also it was very important to him that we would be financially independent. There was no family money there. And so it was really important to him. It was only years later, probably after he passed, that I could lovingly say that he was actually one of the original feminists. So I think it was kind of in me from the beginning. And then specifically when I was at work, I was one of the original co-founders of the Women's Resource Network. And it just always seemed like, well, of course, that's how you would use your talent. I believe that diversity, whether it's women or people in all underrepresented groups, bringing together diverse talent and making sure that all talent has the opportunity to achieve their full potential, I always thought that was important. But it wasn't out of a feeling like I'd been persecuted against or I had opportunities that weren't afforded to me. I just always felt like I wasn't a lawyer, but I did have a voice and I knew how to state a case. And so I always used my talent and my power and my voice for causes like that. You know, the first ever Women's Resource Network at Pepsi back in 1993. We then started a Westchester, which is, you know, suburb of New York City, Westchester Women's Group with companies like Texaco and MasterCard and some of the other companies that were close by in Westchester. You know, I was part of the Women's Food Service Forum. And so I've always been involved in organizations like that. So that's the early route.
Yeah, I love that. And so it obviously informed a lot of the things that not only you would do within your career as an executive, but some of the things that you took on outside of that. And you wrote a book called Aptly, You Should Smile More. And I think I know what the contents of the book just by reading that title. But you did this with a group of your former PepsiCo executives named the Band of Sisters.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So it's incredible that you put this group together or that you all came together. I'm fascinated about the book. Tell us a little bit about what it's about. But I'm also interested in the story of how you all came together to write it.
Yeah. So, You know, it's funny. It was not on my, I hate this expression, but I'm going to use it. Like, it was not on my bucket list or my bingo card to write a book. I always thought it would be nice to have written a book at some point, but it wasn't one of those things that was in my five-year plan when I left corporate America and started doing portfolio work, you know, with executive coaching and board work. This was not really in my plan. And like most good things, it happened very organically. So here's the story. Quickly, we were at a dinner with Indra Nooyi, who had just retired as the CEO and chair of the board of PepsiCo back in 2019.
Okay.
And we're at this very small dinner in Greenwich, Connecticut. A few of us who wrote the book were there, but it was probably only six of us in total. And somehow over the course of the dinner, it came up in conversation that I was one of the co-founders of the first ever Women's Resource Network at Pepsi. And somehow over the dinner, we started talking about little things like at Pepsi, but at companies after that, where you just felt like maybe you didn't really belong. Maybe you couldn't bring your full self to work. And what's funny about that is, not funny, haha, is these are women I'd known forever. I mean, I'd known Indra since as long as she'd been at PepsiCo. I'd known Dawn Hudson since as long as she'd been there. You know, C. Nicholson, I'd known since 1997. I mean, I'd known these people for a long time. We had talked about everything. We had complained about everything. You know, we all complained when somebody changed the date of a strategic planning meeting and he had to work all weekend. I mean, there were a lot of things that were sort of known complaints. But we had never talked about these little moments, these little micro moments that made you feel like you couldn't bring your full self to work. So there we were sitting at this dinner in 2019 with the retired, newly retired CEO and chair of the board of PepsiCo. I mean, at some point, you know, Indra was the third most powerful woman in the world behind like Angela Merkel and Oprah. And here's Indra sharing that she also had experienced some of these things.
Wow.
So one thing led to another. We started talking about them. We did some follow-up meetings. We brought another couple of friends in. And what we realized was we had all experienced these things. We hadn't really talked about them because one by one, they're so small when you say them out loud. Like, why do women get asked to plan the parties versus being on the merger integration task forces? Why do we call women girls in the workplace? Like, you know, why do we tell women not, you know, helpful things like you should smile more? You know, all these little things, they're so tiny one by one, but it's a little bit like death by a thousand cuts. And just over time, what happens is women are, you know, they're either these things are said about them, they're said to them. Most people don't even realize that they're microaggressions. And so you don't talk about them. So one by one, you know, they just kind of add up. And two things happen. Either they just exhaust women. Like at some point, you're just exhausted from dealing with all of these things. Or worse yet, what happens is women get marginalized. So when you talk about women at work, there's a, you know, brand new data scientist with a PhD from Yale, and you say, oh, we just hired this new girl in data science. You don't immediately, when you call a woman a girl at work, you don't immediately think, well, I bet she'll be the next CEO of the company, right? You would never say, oh, we just hired this new boy out of Harvard. You can't say it. Like, you'll do a spit take if you try and say it. You just can't call a person in the workplace, a boy, because they're not 12. And so there's these little things, one by one, they don't mean a lot, but they add up over time. And so we started having these realizations. And what we realized was once we started talking to people about this, everyone had experienced them and nobody talked about them. Because little by little, one by one, they're too small to talk about. But they do add up and they are important.
Yeah, I have a lot to say on this because I've been thinking about this recently. And, you know, the last 4 years were really interesting time for our world, for our society. And you've seen the pendulum kind of swing back and forth on a lot of different things, including traditionally disenfranchised groups or even return to office and all these different things. And we're all kind of coming to a place of like, what's right? What's right for us? What's right for our people? Now, you've seen a lot of people and you know, current events notwithstanding, right? There's this backlash to this idea of woke, or I have to think about before I talk. And it's like, here's my take on this, right? Yes, you have to think before you speak. Like, that should just be a prerequisite, right? You should have some level of empathy of like, how is this going to come across the right way? I'll give an example of this, okay? Uh-huh. Just today, I had a meeting earlier. I have a chief of staff, right, on my team. And I had my chief revenue officer and my CFO. And we're in a meeting. And I had brought my chief of staff in. And I wanted to have notes taken because we didn't have the AI writer, right? And I was about to say, hey, Sammy, can you go ahead? And then I was like, I'm going to pull back. And I'm going to think about it. I'm going to go, you know what, guys? Let's restart this meeting. I'm going to get the note taker and bring it back. I just put in that simple little thought because she knows me. She knows what's going on. But how would it be received, right?
Yeah.
And maybe I should have just gone to my CRO and said, do it, right? To kind of break down these kind of these gender roles. So, yeah, I put a little bit of thought into it, right? To make sure that my message. Yes. So there is a benefit to the person on the other side. You want your message to be heard, not, you know, the tone or the word choice. You want your message to be heard at the end of the day.
Yes.
So I think it's important that, it is a little bit, you have to put a little bit of thought into things before you speak. At the other side, I think, you know, if I can look at it from the other side, it's always too, is like, I think there's some level of patience too, like understanding that their intent wasn't bad or this person hasn't shown that before. So I'm going to give them a little bit of grace on that, but I might tell them, hey, this made me feel this way. So they think about it next time. I think if we just all kind of come together on those types of conversations and put a little more thought before we go in, but also maybe give the benefit of the doubt unless someone's proven not to earn it.
Yeah.
I think everything would be a lot easier on both sides. And I do that a lot, but I'm not 100% either. And when I mess up or when I've said something that came across the wrong way, I try to keep an open door of like, hey, come talk to me and let's figure this out. Because at the end of the day, I want to make it about the work. I want to make it about what we're trying to get done. The last thing I want you to do is walk away from a meeting and be like, I can't believe that this jerk said this or made me feel this way. And so I think there's a little bit of responsibility on both sides, but I think the majority of the responsibility comes from the person communicating. They just have a little bit of empathy because you'd want it on the other side, right? Like if you were called a boy and then somebody came in and said, hey, this boy Oz is the CEO of a company, I'd be like, wait, what?
Is he 12?
You know what I mean? Like, exactly. So the other thing I want to say is, it's funny because I was talking to a podcast a leader named Sanjay Puri, who leads a show called Indianness. And one of the things he talks about is this idea of like, if you look at American CEOs of these big companies, there's a lot of Indian Americans, right?
Yeah.
Satya Nadella, right?
Yeah.
Sundar Pichai. And I always think about one of the first that comes to my mind, and this is why representation across the board does have impact, does matter, is Indira Nooyi, right?
Yeah.
And what she did at PepsiCo, breaking down not only gender barriers, but demographic barriers and race barriers, right? To achieve the level of success she had very early on, right? In terms of the trajectory of that company and what it is today and what we all know it to be. So fascinating, amazing. Yeah. You had that audience. You were there. You wrote this book, okay? Yeah. So the book sounds like it was pretty successful, so much so that you're thinking about writing another one, or what's next on the plate when it comes to authorship?
I was going to say, if my co-authors are listening and they're like, she's out ahead of herself, we're not ready to write another book yet. So we've been out since we wrote the book, we have been out speaking at, you know, corporations and companies all over the U.S. We probably, 2 years after writing the book, we've probably done more than 50 of them. And we love that. We love speaking to people. We speak to co-ed audiences. Again, as I said before, these little moments that we talk about, we always assume positive intent. Like with most unconscious buyers, we assume both men and women, they're not waking up in the morning saying, I'm going to hold women back. I'm going to ask them to take the notes. Nobody's doing that. So it's about kind of bringing people in, helping people to become allies, both men and women, people of all genders. And so we love that. We love bringing people in, creating awareness, and then we give people really practical tips on what you could say or do or not say or not do literally in your next meeting. So it's very energizing for us, and our hope is to continue to do that. So that's the first thing that we're doing, is we're out speaking everywhere. And then we're actually just kicking off which may lead to a second book at some point. But when we first started, when we first wrote the book, we interviewed hundreds of women. We were trying to figure out these little micro moments. Some people would call them microaggressions, but these little moments of unconscious bias. We aligned on about 30, 35 of them, and we had some tips and tricks about what you can do. And again, there were six of us writing the book. So the idea is there isn't just one thing you could say or do. as the person receiving it, as an ally of any gender, as a boss of any gender. And it's a little bit of a choose your own adventure. You know, sometimes you might agree with what Katie says or what Lori says or C, Angelique, Missy says. And so we liked the fact that it was kind of a multi-voice approach. But we interviewed hundreds of women, largely because we wanted to make sure that these little micro moments, like, were they still happening today? I mean, we wanted to talk to a bunch of women, 25 to 40 year old, to say, is this still happening? Yes or no? And then if so, tell us what you do or say or have seen that is helpful in terms of kind of combating these. So we did hundreds of hours of interviews before we wrote the book. And now here we are several years later. And what we're realizing is we talk a lot about allyship. We love allies of all genders. And we really love senior male allies who understand this. We've seen it in meetings. We'll be in a presentation. There'll be a male CEO who will introduce us. And we're there. This has happened multiple times where we're going through these little vignettes and you watch these male leaders and they'll say, oh, gosh, I didn't realize that was a thing. Like, I didn't realize I've told women to smile more. I was doing it to try and be helpful. But, oh, my gosh, you're right. I would never tell a man to smile more. I would never say a man's too emotional. Oh, gosh. And so they have these moments of learning right there, you know, in front of hundreds of other employees. And that is so much growth. And so we love kind of, we always say we're not calling men out, none of this woke stuff, none of this being harsh on people, assume positive intent, call men in. But we're actually setting out on a fairly big research agenda where we're going to go out and interview male C-suite leaders, CEOs on, you know, what kind of their moments of allyship are. You know, sort of what they're noticing, what they notice they're doing, how they're kind of bringing other people along to be allies. And so I think that's kind of our next big endeavor, whether someday it results in another book or not, who knows. But I'm really interested in doing that work because we hear it anecdotally. And again, most people wake up in the morning and want to do the right thing by everybody. And whether it's because they're good people or they have good values or just because they're pragmatic business people and realize that it's good for business when you have diverse teams with diverse points of view, with diverse backgrounds, right? And honestly, if you want to have access to the best talent, you want to have access to the best talent of people of all genders, all races, ethnicities, background, ages, and that's just good for business. And if you're a capitalist, that's okay if you get there because you're a capitalist. I don't need people to get there for values. I'm okay if people get there because they're capitalist.
Outcome-oriented. I really like that. Now listen, whenever the book's ready, I'm going to need an autographed copy from every single one of the Banda sisters, so let me know. Super excited about that.
Finding the right talent for your team doesn't have to be a struggle. Meet Aon Hire, the world's first hiring experience management platform designed to transform the way you hire. Powered by AI, Aon Hire takes the hassle out of every step in the process. From smart resume analysis to customized interview questions, it saves you time, money, and effort. Plus, with real-time insights from every interview, you can quickly identify top candidates, reduce turnover, and stay on budget. And forget about note-taking. Aon Hire takes care of that for you. Ready to revolutionize your hiring process? Visit aonhire.com and get started today.
One of the things that I like to say in my organization is, particularly because there have been times where I am externally calling something out because it needs to be called out.
Yes.
But internally, I don't call people out. I call them up.
Yeah.
And the key to that is intent, right? Is your intent to make things better? Is your intent to injure or to make them, you know, feel bad about themselves? No. So then you're calling them up, calling them up to their best selves, calling them up to what the company needs, calling them up to what everybody needs. So I love that you said that, and that really resonated with me.
Yeah, I love that, calling them up. We always say calling them in, right? Bringing them into the discussion. But I love calling them up and assuming positive intent. And sometimes—
Did I just make the book?
What?
Am I in the book? Okay, no one's going to be that impressed with the CEO of MSJM. Maybe they will. I don't know.
I think I just made the book. Are you there? But it's interesting. We were at a talk early on with a former colleague, And he was interviewing us, and he asked a question, and then he said, am I allowed to say that? You know, it was sort of in the height of a little bit of this, after the Me Too backlash. And just to be clear, we're not talking about Me Too moments. We're not talking about, God forbid, Jeffrey Epstein, Harvey Weinstein. We're talking about little microaggressions. Not even in the same kind of the same sphere. But I said to him, I said, you know what? I think that's a really good question. But rather than framing the question, am I allowed to say that, as though it's like a gotcha moment, I said, just think of it this way. Like you said before, which is, from the time that you can speak, your parents are telling you to think before you speak. That is not a bad rule of thumb. And as a general rule, what we tell people is, sometimes people aren't sure what they can say. You have to consider the audience, how someone will receive something. But as a general rule, 50% of the time, if you just say to yourself, something you're about to say to a woman, would you say it to a man? That's probably going to get you 50% of the way there, right? Oh, I had this just happen just a couple of weeks ago. I was in a meeting, and I was wearing, you know, I don't know, I was wearing like a nice blouse, and I zhuzhed it up with some jewelry and whatever, and maybe a little bling. And one of my colleagues said to me, he said, oh, you look very glamorous to say. And then he said, you look very glamorous today. And then he kind of caught himself and he said, oh, am I allowed to say that? Is that okay? And I said, well, thank you. I mean, obviously when I got kind of dressed up and zhuzhed it up a little bit about that morning, I wouldn't have minded if somebody had noticed that I put a little bit of extra effort in. I was wearing something that I felt great in. And I said, no, thank you. I appreciate that. And then I just said to him, I said, like, I didn't say learning moment. I literally didn't label it a learning moment. But I said, just like, would you say it? And there was another guy standing there. I'll call him Bob. That wasn't his name. But I said, would you say a similar thing to Bob? And he said, yeah, he said, I would say to Bob, hey, you're looking really dapper in that. I love that blazer. And I said, you know what? For me, that's how I took it. And I said, thank you. But I think in terms of like the second thought that was in your head, which is maybe not everybody would have received it the same way Lori did. So always consider the audience. That's just good communication. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I said to him, I said, you didn't say, ooh, Lori, you're looking sexier. Like I said, you didn't say anything weird. And so it was obvious that your intention was very good, and I appreciated it as such. So, but I think what you said, Oz, is think before you speak. Yeah, that's not a high bar to put on people.
No, right? No, I know. And we do it across all different types of spectrums of things that come out of our mouth, whether it be setting a strategy and a plan or who you invite to. Like, I mean, putting a little thought into things isn't the biggest thing in the world. And if that's all we're asking to make everybody feel included and feel good, I don't think it's a big deal. And just to your point, I gotta be honest, I usually am wearing a t-shirt and sneakers when I come in here. Today I have a dinner, so I had a blazer on and things like that. And both, you know, male and female employees both called out, hey, you look different, you look dapper, you look good today. And yeah, listen, that's not a bad thing as long as you do it in the appropriate way. I gotta say, first, you know, two zhuzhes in the podcast. That's double the zhuzhes we've ever had before. So we're breaking records here. And then lastly, I have three daughters and I adore them, and I see it the same way I think your dad sees it. And so I really appreciate the work you're doing. So I want to thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you. I also have two daughters, and I will share one other thing with you. When we had this dinner back with Indra back in 2019, my younger daughter was about to graduate from college. And so second of two. And I had this realization as we started doing this work, that when we started the first ever Women's Resource Network back in, so many years prior, 1993, I don't think I ever said these words aloud, but I was thinking, okay, we'll do this work now. I don't have children now. We'll do this work now. We'll like fix gender bias, like check. We'll make everything equal. Sort of like the analogy I always use is, when I was a kid, we didn't wear seatbelts. Our mothers took us home from the hospital, sitting in the front seat, no car seat, no seatbelts, and she was probably smoking a cigarette. And then at some point, people did the like, you need to wear seatbelts. And now we just get in the car and we put on our seatbelts. We don't talk about it. We don't boast about it. We don't post on Instagram. We just don't wear seatbelts. Similarly, we don't litter. We don't like throw our trash out the window. So there were other things like that, that like you put in the work And then you thought they would just be solved and we would go do other things. So I think back in 1993, I think that's what I thought would happen with, you know, diversity, inclusion and all of that. And sitting there in 2019, years later, when my baby is about to graduate from college, I'm going to cry. I had this moment where I sort of thought, oh my God, I've been doing this for so long. And I, you know, I've worked a lot of hours. I lived in different cities, commuted to different cities while I was a working parent to, for my career, but also for my family and economic security. My husband and I were in like a dual working relationship. We did all of that. I've been part of Women's Resource Network since 1993. My kid's about to graduate from college and we didn't fix it. We didn't fix it. And I have to say, I'm getting a little emotional thinking about it. I wanted to have fixed it so that it would be easier and better for them. And we didn't. But the flip side of that is we all had this realization where we said, okay, we used to be operating executives. Now we're executive coaches. We're board directors. We're speakers. We have agency. We have power. We have a voice. We can use that to try and get done what we didn't get done maybe, you know, 30 years prior when, you know, I was like a brand manager at Pepsi.
Yeah, so here's what I'll tell you about that. I think fix it is one way to look at it, but I'd reframe for you and say that we've made incredible progress. Not yeah. Everybody puts on their seatbelt. I can look down there and I can see somebody littering right now. But we're more aware. It's definitely yes. better. I can yes. definitely tell you that. And then when I watch TV or movies and I watch something that came on like in the 90s versus right now, I mean, there's a completely different tact and script and everything. True. So I would say that fixed is the wrong frame. That's progress, and we want to keep progressing and keep moving forward. And through your work, we're able to do it. Now, listen. We got to talk talent because that's what pays the bills here. And yeah. I know you've hired a lot of people in your career. So I want to ask you a couple questions when it comes to your hiring practices. Do you have a core hiring philosophy that you've adhered to as you brought people into your team?
Mm-hmm. I go back to the thing that I learned, the gentleman I referenced earlier who hired me right off the Penn campus. I tell a story. We were going to, again, I was probably 21. We were going to interview maybe at University of Georgia, we were in Atlanta, and we're all getting in the car. And I said, like, Dave, I don't know how to interview. Like, I don't know what we're interviewing for. Like, I was kind of freaked out. I didn't have a rubric, you know, or a framework. And again, this guy was a super talented executive. And he just looked me in the eye and I said, oh, it's just super simple. He said, you just hire people that are smarter, more clever, harder working, more creative than you are or I am. And then the company will do well. They'll do well, we'll do well, and we'll all make a lot of money. I was like, that's it. He's like, that's it. And bring snacks in the car. I was like, okay. And so it was so simple. I know that sounds so basic, but I think that whole notion of, I know what I'm good at. I know what I'm great at. I know what my superpowers are. I also know what I'm not that good at. And again, to the extent that you're always looking to bring talent in, that's going to make everything better. And I really say that it's no false humility. I want to bring in talent that I think somebody is better than I am. I really do. I love when you bring in talent and you say, oh, well, I'll be working for this person someday. So I think that is, at the end of the day, that's the biggest principle for me. And I also think, like we were talking about earlier, I love to bring in people that are hungry, that want to learn, that have intellectual curiosity, that are, you know, sort of want to put in more than they're going to get out of it, and just have a great attitude. I have a colleague who used to say all the time, like, I will take attitude over aptitude yeah. any day of the week. And I think he was right about that.
My guy, Dave House, was out in front. He knew talent identification. He knew candidate experience by bringing the snacks. I mean, I should talk to this guy. He's got some good ideas. What about a memorable interview experience? If I asked you about one of those, is there one that comes to mind?
You know, I have two things. I just told this story the other day. I interview for, you know, I serve on corporate boards. And as part of that, you interview for a lot of corporate boards. You know, you don't always get offered the role. years ago, I interviewed for a corporate board role, and it went very well. But like most board roles, everyone that interviews is super qualified. So you don't get offended if you don't get asked back for a third or fourth interview, or ultimately if you don't get it. Anyway, I had a first interview that I knew it went really well. The head of the governance committee sent me a handwritten note card thanking me for interviewing and telling me what he appreciated about the how much he enjoyed meeting with me and how much he appreciated the interview. This was probably 2016. I was cleaning out my kitchen recently, so 8 years later, and I finally just threw it away. But I kept it for 8 years. And the key thing for me there was, we all tell people, write a handwritten thank you note when you're being interviewed. But that was probably the first, last, and only time where someone sent me, it wasn't just like an email, like, hey, thanks for interviewing, we enjoyed it. He sent me a handwritten note. And it stuck with me incredibly so. And I think it was just a learning about, I tell people this all the time, when you're interviewing, both as the interviewer and the interviewee, think about the notion that, like, please God, life is long, and that you may interact with that person in some other way down the road. So I've had people that have interviewed, they weren't the right person for the role, but I recommended them to recruiters for other jobs when somebody called me for a referral. Like, they made such an impact on me, even though they might not have had the best skill set for the role. So both as the interviewee, think about, yes, ideally you want to get invited back and ultimately you want to get the offer, but it's a longer game than that if we're lucky enough to be here for a long time. But the learning is, Oz, the same thing goes for the person who's doing the interviewing. So that's really something like that has really stuck with me for a very long time. And then the flip side of that is, so when I worked at Keurig, I was the head of brand and product, but there was a whole engineering team that we worked really closely with. And the guy who ran the mechanical engineering group, he said when he interviewed mechanical engineers, if they hadn't come to the interview and had bought and taken apart a Keurig machine, they didn't get to a second interview. Now, it's not like it's a Rolls Royce or like a Mercedes Benz, but it's like, you know, the cheapest Keurig was probably $89. So I'm like, you know, these people that are interviewing for relatively junior roles, you expected them to have like bought a Keurig and taken it apart. And the learning, the essence of what he said really stuck with me, which is they have to be intellectually curious. If you're interviewing for mechanical engineering manager role and you're not curious enough to have gotten in there and taken the thing apart, he's like, you're not going to do well here. And I thought it was harsh at the time, but years later, just a couple years later, I was at Peloton back in the early days, and you know, the company wasn't as ubiquitous as it became during the, you know, COVID epidemic. But we had N number of stores, and certainly we had, you know, we had a store in New Jersey, we had a store at the Westchester Mall. There were stores in the New York area where you could get on a Peloton and try it. And I remember I would interview people, I was building out the marketing department, and I would interview people and I would say, you know, what was your experience like when you got on a Peloton? And they would say, I haven't been on one. And I just remember thinking, if you're not, I mean, we were like a young and growing company. There's so many people who are passionate about product, passionate about fitness, passionate about branding. And if you're not curious enough to have even come to our office, you know, which had a showroom in it, sometime before the interview, which was set up at least a week in advance, you're probably not going to have the intellectual curiosity to work here. So I guess if I were headlining that thought, I would say the upside is what I told you earlier about sort of realizing the role that you play as an interviewee and an interviewer. That's a very positive story. The opposite side of that is like showing intellectual curiosity or not showing intellectual curiosity, as the case may be.
I really like that. It's a great lesson. Show your interest. You do that in different ways, not just asking questions in an interview. And unrelated, I may or may not have been a family member that was visiting me last week, but my DeLonghi Magnifica broke. And I was last night looking at the back of this thing, and you said it wasn't a Rolls Royce. This thing is like rocket science. Yes. So if any of those people that managed to handle the Keurig well, will you send them my way? You said you do referrals, so I need help right now. My coffee's broken. Do you have a favorite question you love to ask?
Oh, my gosh. I love to ask any question that shows that people can hold up a mirror to themselves and can learn. And I, you know, everyone comes prepared with like their, you know, the things that they did well and all of their successes. And then people tend to have their trite answers about, you know, what's a weakness of yours. And they say, well, I work too hard or I'm too results oriented or whatever. But I really like to just ask people about like, just reflect on something that you could have done better, a learning that came out of it, even something that had gone well. What could you have done that would have made it even more effective? A time where maybe you didn't succeed, and what you learned from it. Whether people have succeeded or we've all succeeded in things, and we've all had some failures. And I'm not a big, you know, sort of spend all your time talking about your failures. But in, you know, in the military, they do these after action reviews. When I worked in retail, we had a very, very tight process. We called it hindsight. And after every season, you know, after like Black Friday, Cyber Monday, or after moms, dads, and grads, or whatever, New Year, New You, we always did a very formal hindsight review of what went well, what didn't go well, what we learned, what we're going to do differently, you know, in 51 weeks where that same holiday is going to happen again. And so I think that same discipline should apply to your leadership, to business situations. You know, what could have gone better and what did you learn? And how people talk about that and how they talk about their learning and being reflective, I think to me is a good indicator of how much they're going to be a lifelong learner if they come to work with you.
Really good stuff. I want to jump into a little bit of a different lane.
Sure.
Let me ask you about a good book you read recently. You've written books, but is there a good book you'd recommend for our listeners out there that they might like?
I am right now, I just started reading Ali Velshi's book.
Okay.
He's a,
Who's Ali Velshi? Because
I'm Ali Velshi is a, he's a Canadian journalist. He has a show on MSNBC and, he is, I know his wife, which is, I went to his book event and, you know, several months ago. And what I really like about the book is it's his story and, you know, growing up, different country, all of that, talks a lot about his, you know, sort of his path to citizenship. It's not a political book per se. And, but I think it's a good example of what I'm talking about, which is somebody who is like reflective, learns from their history. And what's sort of super fascinating about this book is, and I'm only about 20% in, it's learning from your own history, but the history of your ancestors as well. Yeah. And sort of looking back, at, like I said, your history, where you come from, what other people have done to get you in the place that you can live the life that we all live. And I feel, you know, we joke, sometimes we'll complain about something and then we'll go, oh, first world problems. But I think the world would be a little bit better if we all realize that we have, each of us, we have so much privilege living where we live at the time that we live. We have access to clean drinking water. You know, even though for most people, like prices are too high and all of that, we have privilege that we're not even conscious of. You know, clean drinking water, air that we can breathe, access to transportation. I mean, all of these things. And because we live in a world, I think those of us, again, I've spent my whole career in very commercial businesses, and you tend to compare yourself against other people and who has a bigger house, or their kids went to a better school, or they take nicer vacations or whatever. And it's very easy to get wrapped up in the sort of go forward and comparing yourself to other people. And sometimes taking a look back, and this is one of the things, like I said, early on in the book, but looking back on these ancestors and what they did to get us to where we are today. I mean, my grandparents came here, typical immigrant story. Grandfather came over, was here for 6 years. My grandmother was back in Poland with three little boys. And, you know, he was working a less than minimum wage job, just putting every penny away until he could send for my grandmother to come on a ship 6 years later. I mean, we all have stories like that. But I think to take a minute to reflect on we are here today because of what other people did before us is something that I really appreciate. I'm trying to take a moment to do that, like I said, with my own ancestors, and I appreciate other people that are doing it with theirs, because we're here today because of them.
Love that. I think the book's called Small Acts of Courage. You tell me if I'm wrong.
Yes, okay. Yes.
A little crack research over here. All right, crack last question research. Before we do our quick lightning round. Any advice that you'd give your 20-year-old self that you didn't know then, but that you know now?
Yeah. The advice I would give to my 20-year-old self would be, it's a little bit of an offshoot of what I said before, which is stop only focusing on what you're not good at. Take the things that you're not good at and get them to standard. And when I say things that you're not good at, I mean for the chosen profession that you have. Like, I'm not good at chemistry. I don't need to be good at chemistry. I'm not a chemist. But for the things that I might not be good at in what I do, you have to get them to standard so that they don't get in the way. But they don't need to become strengths. And so take your development needs and get them to standard so they don't get in the way. And then focus on your strengths. What would they look like if they were towering strengths? Take your towering strengths. If you really leaned into them, what would it look like if they were best in class, or if you were the best in the world at that? And I think that is a much more fruitful way of going through a career versus constantly beating yourself up about what you're not good at and focusing on that. So that's part one. And the part two, kind of the cousin to that, is just because something comes easy to you does not mean it's not a strength. And I'm almost embarrassed to say that out loud because it sounds so obvious, but there are things that I'm good at that come easy to me. And I used to not give myself credit for them because I thought the only things that quote unquote counted were the things where like you worked hard and then you got good at them. And so the things that come easy to you that you're good at, those count. Those help you be very good at your job. And so don't discount them. Think about yourself holistically. And again, lean into things that you're good at. I didn't say pursue your passions. That's a different thing. But again, take your things that you're not good at, get them to standard, and then really focus on taking the things you're good at and trying to be great and awesome and best in the world at.
Yeah, we have some similar lines of thoughts. I figured this out about 10, 15 years ago because I was trying to be, good at everything. And I realized you only have so much time to really focus. So I started to lean into my strengths. And then the way I frame the other side is make sure that your downsides are not liabilities. As long as they're not liabilities, then you're going to be okay. And then you really lean into your superpowers. That's a great way to go about your career. Let me run through some quick lightning round, okay? Here's where we're going. We're going to go marketing lean. What company do you think is currently doing marketing at a level above everybody else?
Can I pass? Do the next one?
Okay,
I have to think about that one.
That's okay.
It's funny.
What about historically? Is there a historic company that you just think that they crushed the marketing?
I tend to think of less about the marketing and more about kind of branding and product and the whole experience, less just about traditionally what we think about marketing. I was at an event last night and the president or CEO of Madewell was there. And I was telling her the story about how I am all in on Madewell in a time where you know, retailers are, you know, some of them have struggled, many of them have gone out of business. What I love about Madewell is you walk into the store, there's an energy in the store. I love their product. And what I really love about it is one of the places where my 27-year-old daughter and I, we both, like, we drove to Westport, Connecticut because we both wanted to go to Madewell. And it had a vibe that felt good to her, and it had a vibe that felt good to me. And so I love brands that that kind of know who they are. They don't try and be all things to all people, but the retail experience felt good. There was energy in the store. And so I'm leaning in on Madewell right now.
I like
now.
That. Madewell. What's a campaign historically that you would have liked to have been a part of? A really successful one.
I should have prepared for these.
No, that's why it's lightning round. You got to think of the first thing that comes to your head. What was the first campaign that came to mind?
The first thing that came to mind, this is a weird thing because it was a, it was actually a Coke commercial, but from when I was super young, remember the Mean Joe Green and he throws in his jersey.
Yeah.
And the reason that I bring that up is I still think today, and especially in this world that we live with so much fragmented media, kind of the, you know, it's so hard to get people's attention. The thing that you remember is how things made you feel. And as I say, I don't remember the dialogue, but literally I can picture the look in, you know, in that little kid's eye when the guy threw him his jersey.
Yeah.
And that feeling of like capturing emotion, I think is something that that is harder and harder now with this attention economy. But when you feel it, you remember that feeling.
I hope
sorry
band,
to all my
I
friends.
I hope the band of sisters don't listen to this. Oh my goodness, we're going to go. All right, last one. Why the heck are insurance companies so innovative and funny with their advertising? Like, what is it about the industry? They just make so much money. They have marketing spend, or what is it?
You should interview C, one of the band of sisters. She's a longtime board member of a publicly traded insurance company, so she may have more to say on this topic. But I think what's interesting about that is it sort of illustrates what we were talking about a minute ago, which is you have to appeal to people in terms of other things beyond just intellectual, like features and benefits. And so when you think about these insurance companies, they have to kind of make themselves memorable and appeal to you on something other than, like, you know, sort of rates and products and things like that. And so they do it in fun and memorable ways.
Yeah, it's just, if you think about it, let's think about it. Geico. We got the Gecko, you got Gecko. The Caveman, you've got Flo from Progressive, you got Jake from State Farm, right? You got the Chaos guy, right? I don't even know what insurance he is. There's just, I'm always watching these commercials and I chuckle and I'm like, what does this have to do with car insurance? And why are these so memorable, right?
Right. But that's Lord, it. You answered your question. It's about being memorable.
But why is it not being copied in like other industries? I don't get it. Laura, I really appreciate the time. I think you're doing amazing work. I'm excited for the next book. I hope
Thank
the Band
you.
Of Sisters are listening and love this episode. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Oz.
All right, Laura, I'll talk to you later.
Okay.